just to protect corporate shareholders, but also to protect the rest of society from frighteningly expansive corporate power to influence every aspect of our lives. History provides ample support for this view. In the 18th and 19th centuries, U.S. corporations were created by government charters that limited them to specific purposes. This was derived from the British system created in the 1600s, when the monarch granted monopolies to groups of people to incentivize them to undertake ventures that the government had an interest in. Alexander Hamilton, for instance, successfully argued for a federally chartered national bank, and in the 1800s, the federal government granted charters to Union Pacific Railroad and others to create the Transcontinental Railroad. In the early 19th century, each U.S. corporation had to receive a special charter from the legislature laying out its purpose. States granted charters to corporations to pursue very narrow purposes, for example, to build a bridge. Corporations were legally barred from going beyond the scope of their charters and could be sued for doing so. If a corporation were granted a charter to build a bridge and tried to build a general purpose road instead, it would lose all of the formal benefits of incorporation, including limited liability. By the 1800s, the U.S. had shifted to a model of general incorporation, in which states granted charters to any corporation that met fixed statutory requirements. But the underlying statutory requirement to sharply limit the scope of corporate activities remained intact. In Massachusetts, for instance, a corporation had to have a single specific purpose set out in its charter, and the law generally held corporate actions unconnected to that purpose void, with only unanimous shareholder consent able to alter a corporation's charter-specified purpose. This restriction became so fundamental that it came to bear the signifying hallmark of any truly important legal doctrine, a Latin name. It was called the ultra vires doctrine, beyond the powers. Today, almost all corporate charters allow corporations to conduct any lawful business, and the ultra vires doctrine has become a formality that only has serious legal consequences for nonprofit corporations and state-created ones like universities. But history teaches us a lot. For most of our nation's life, our law has held that corporations were granted their special legal protections as part of a package deal, saying that their activities had to be strictly limited to the narrow purposes outlined in their charters. The general form version of those charters today is the mandate to simply maximize shareholder value and to avoid pursuing other activities that could result in a greater aggregation of corporate power than society intended. Making the pursuit of profit the corporation's singular mission wasn't simply a matter of administrative convenience. It was a fundamentally new American invention. In the old world European model, what is now termed classical corporatism, the role of the corporation was to serve as one among many societal institutions tasked with the betterment of the public at large. In Europe, business leaders were supposed to work with labor leaders, church officials, and politicians to determine and implement the common good. But in America, the job of corporate managers has been to maximize profits alone, leaving it to other institutions to look after broader societal goals. The genius of the American vision was to separate the activities of innovators and entrepreneurs from those of other societal institutions, like church and state and local governments. While the leaders of other institutions, including government, looked after the interests of society at large, American capitalists were legally obligated to look after only their own interests. History supports this view, but so does common sense. Society gave corporations superpowers. Foremost among them was the gift of limited liability. In return, society demanded that companies use that power for only a narrow set of activities, namely to make products and services, to prevent them from wielding too much power in our politics and other non-commercial spheres of our lives. Advocates of classical capitalism like Milton Friedman wrongly assumed that both fundamental features of the corporation, limited shareholder liability and the mandate to maximize shareholder value, were strictly about incentivizing entrepreneurs and investors to unleash innovation. They ignored the way in which limited shareholder liability would create titanic corporate monsters with power heretofore unimagined, offering no coherent theory for how society should constrain the power of those monsters outside the marketplace. By contrast, advocates of stakeholder capitalism were correct to acknowledge a social contract between shareholders and society, in which shareholders owe something back to society in return for the great gift of limited liability. They were also correct to recognize that the social contract was one that demanded restraint from corporations. They erred only in surmising that this social contract was implicit and that corporate restraint was about tamping down the pure pursuit of profit. To the contrary, if limited liability was the quid from society, then the mandate to maximize shareholder value was the quo from corporations. That was the true grand bargain. The requirement to maximize profits wasn't just about protecting shareholders, as Milton Friedman types had assumed. It was about protecting the rest of society from a Frankensteinian corporate monster. That's why we keep the monster trapped in the cage of capitalism, to protect democracy and other civic institutions from a monster that, once unleashed, would exercise more power than any business or person ever should. Just as society demands that nonprofits confine their activities to the sphere of charitable causes in return for tax-exempt status, with for-profit corporations, society did precisely the reverse. Not just to protect shareholders, but to protect democracy and our other institutions. And therein lies the solution to the true problem of expansive corporate power in the 21st century. Limit the scope of limited shareholder liability itself. That might sound scary to business elites at first, but on inspection, its effect is intuitive and even mundane. Institutional shareholders like BlackRock, one of the largest asset managers and proponents of stakeholder capitalism, should enjoy the benefit of the limited liability shield when their portfolio companies produce goods and services for profit. But if BlackRock uses the corporate shield to implement its own vision of social responsibility for society by using its portfolio companies as vehicles for advancing that agenda, then aggrieved consumers, employees, and other stakeholders shouldn't just be limited to suing those corporations. They should be able to go after BlackRock directly, as well as any other social activist shareholder of that corporation. Let's get specific. Suppose there's a parade organized by a bunch of social activists around a particular cause, say, climate change. Right now, if a regular social activist drives a car in that parade and crashes into someone, she faces personal tort liability. She could be sued in court and lose everything she has. But now, suppose she's the owner of a company and sends one of her employees in the company car to do the same thing, and the exact same thing happens. Then she can't be sued. Her personal assets are protected by limited liability. That gives her a shield that ordinary social activists don't get. That's the shield that woke shareholders like BlackRock or other ESG investors enjoy on a large scale today. So I'm just proposing that we level the playing field and make those woke shareholders like BlackRock or Al Gore's Generation Investment Management bear the same liability as any ordinary social activist when they engage in ordinary social activism through the companies that they invest in. Limited shareholder liability was never meant to protect well-heeled woke investors from the consequences of their actions during PR stunts at woke parades. Yet that's precisely the privilege that these woke shareholders enjoy today, one that society never intended to provide when it created limited shareholder liability in the first place. This solution may seem modest, but it would completely reorder stakeholder capitalism. Today, BlackRock preaches about the need for corporations to meet the standards of its Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, since as a shareholder, it is protected from liability from anything that its portfolio companies do. Yet the corporate shield was created to incentivize capital formation for the pursuit of profit, not to use the corporate shield as a way of conducting a protected form of social activism. If BlackRock were to face tort liability for its social advocacy efforts, like an ordinary human social activist would, then its willingness to embrace those social causes would predictably change. Of course, shareholders like BlackRock can avail themselves in court of the affirmative defense that their primary interest was simply the pursuit of profit rather than any other social or charitable agenda. In that case, they would continue to benefit from the shield of limited liability, which exists precisely to protect for-profit corporate activities. But it would also reveal the true essence of stakeholder capitalism for the self-interested farce that it is, in a way that would enlighten consumers and citizens alike about the true motivations of today's newly woke capitalist class. It's the same motivation that Milton Friedman surmised all along, the pursuit of self-interest above all. For those like me who believe the rise of wokenomics represents a problem for democracy, the simple answer is to limit the scope of limited liability of the corporation to cover only the set of activities it was intended to cover. A corporation ought to be free to pursue activities that go beyond the pursuit of profit. America is a free country, after all. But to the extent that it does, its social activist shareholders shouldn't receive any special protection from direct liability. There is no government regulatory action needed here, just a simple legal fix, arguably a form of deregulation, that clarifies that the construct of limited liability is, well, limited. I kept my promise to my employees to engage in a day of reflection on Juneteenth. Though I was initially frustrated by the employee backlash, I learned something valuable from it. It forced me to think about how to build a better company. I began the day wondering where the social revolution had come from. But I ended the day by asking the question of how the social tumult in America could push Roivant to become the best version of itself. A new week brought a new town hall and a new chance to engage with my socially conscious employees. I told my employees that I'd realized Roivant had indeed fallen short of its goals. One of our founding values was scrappiness. It might as well have been written in our corporate charter. Think big, stay scrappy, we often said. We weren't supposed to be one of those glossy big pharma companies. We were always supposed to be the young upstarts with chips on our shoulders. We were supposed to be hungry. And we needed to recruit fresh hires who saw themselves as underdogs too. For years, we had prioritized Ivy League schools in our campus recruiting process. Sure, there are plenty of scrappy kids at Harvard, just as there are at state universities. But recruiting Ivy League grads wasn't automatically going to select for hunger and scrappiness. There was another issue too. As CEO, I often declared with pride that we valued diversity of thought and diversity of experience among our employee base. But if I'm being honest, we weren't actually doing very much to screen for diversity of thought or diversity of experience in our recruiting process, even though we declared that to be an important objective. At the prior week's town hall, one of my employees had been brave enough to publicly challenge me about that in front of the entire company, pointing to a campus recruiting process that was concentrated heavily on Ivy League universities. At the time, I had answered her question defensively, meekly pointing to the fact that colleges like Harvard and Yale already invested immense efforts to create diverse student bodies. But as a company, when did we simply take someone else's judgment as gospel without pressure testing it ourselves, especially about something we said was important? Answer, we didn't. If anything, we prided ourselves on being contrarian. So on that Zoom call the following week with my employees, I made a surprise announcement about a new hiring policy. One not only that would help keep Roivant scrappy, but that respected our longstanding business principle that actions speak louder than words. I announced that we would prioritize recruiting a certain number of candidates who grew up in a family where the household income was below the 25th percentile. Over the last year, Roivant has since expanded the program to be more inclusive by increasing the qualification threshold to below the 50th percentile. If one of those employees joined our company and remained employed by us for 4 years, we would assume any outstanding student debt that they had up to a total of $100,000. And we would implement that program without compromising on the other qualities we seek from our job candidates. The announcement came as a shock to the entire company. To be sure, some employees thought I'd once again missed the moment, since the program made no mention of fighting racism or standing with the black community. But for many of my employees, it was exactly the kind of solution they'd been yearning for. From my perspective, recruiting less economically privileged employees wasn't a means to the end of fighting racism per se. It wasn't even a means to the end of solving inequality. That was important work for American democracy to tackle. Rather, our new policy was just one small way to make Roivant a better company. As CEO, that was my own small way of making the world better, too. Chapter 4. The Rise of the Managerial Class. My employees at Roivant who pushed me to do more as CEO were sincere in their desire for justice. But it's more often the case that high-powered executives are the ones pushing their own values on everyone else. While they may claim to be pursuing justice or responding to stakeholders, when members of America's managerial class mix business and politics, it's usually about burnishing their own personal reputation and power. To successfully merge business with politics, managerial elites must control both. As it turns out, the managerial class seized control of government long before it captured private industry. The year 2020 offered a case in point. Shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, on the morning of Friday, October 2, 2020, the world learned via Twitter that President Trump had tested positive for COVID-19. Given President Trump's age and health, there was a very real chance that the President of the United States might become incapacitated or even die on the eve of the presidential election. President Trump was admitted to the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Washington, D.C., where he received an unconventional combination of medicines. One of them was an unapproved antibody cocktail from a biotech company called Regeneron. By Monday, President Trump had departed Walter Reed feeling healthy. In a widely publicized video later that week, President Trump voiced his opinion that the investigational therapy from Regeneron is what made the biggest difference in his recovery. The idea isn't crazy. Regeneron's cocktail contained antibodies that were specifically engineered to bind to the virus responsible for the COVID-19 infection. Regeneron had used the same approach to successfully treat Ebola. The company's clinical trial had been promising. That's why President Trump's doctors made special arrangements for him to receive this therapy, even though it wasn't yet approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. If I'd had an elder family member who'd contracted the virus at the same time as President Trump, I'd have wanted them to receive the exact same treatment regimen as him. But here's the rub. There's no way that would have happened. I couldn't have accessed Regeneron's therapy for a family member. I was a well-connected biotech CEO and still wouldn't have stood a chance. Hundreds of thousands of hospitalized COVID-19 patients could simply forget about it. The reason? A three-letter answer. FDA. Regeneron's antibody cocktail wasn't FDA approved at the time that President Trump received it. As it happens, President Trump belongs to the same golf club as Len Schleifer, the CEO of Regeneron. And President Trump was also the president. So he was in a unique position to make one phone call and immediately access an investigational therapy that no ordinary American could. It's obvious that the President of the United States should get the best possible treatment. The problem was that everyone else couldn't, because of barriers erected by the U.S. government itself. That may sound puzzling, and it's particularly ironic to have been the case under President Trump's watch, since he was the one to champion right-to-try legislation before Congress. The name of the law summarizes it well. It gives patients a right to try treatment options that aren't yet FDA approved. Except it didn't, in the end. Here's a dark secret that most Americans don't know. No respectable biotech or pharma company actually makes its investigational therapies available to patients via right to try. Companies simply refuse to engage with it. The reason? Once again, the FDA. The agency absolutely hates the right to try law. If patients need to access drugs before they're approved, the FDA prefers a different program, the expanded access program that's overseen by the FDA rather than right to try, which is not. As a side note, this is actually the program through which President Trump accessed Regeneron's antibody cocktail. Maybe that's a reasonable perspective. But even if the FDA doesn't like right to try, it's still the law of the land, right? In name, yes. In reality, no. The general rule of thumb in the pharma industry is this. you do what the FDA wants. Period. It's well known in the industry that if you indulge right to try, then you do so at your own peril. As the old adage in pharma goes, FDA never forgets. Companies don't make money when making drugs available through right to try, but every year of delay in formal FDA approval to sell the drug could be very costly. All it takes is a line-level bureaucrat citing some technicality as the reason for a delay. Measured against that risk, no rational company wants to alienate the FDA, even if that means giving a cold shoulder to right to try. As if there were any doubt, the FDA makes its view known in no uncertain terms. There is no evidence that either bill would meaningfully improve access for patients, but both would remove FDA from the process and create a dangerous precedent that would erode protections for vulnerable patients, a group of former FDA leaders wrote. It was typical FDA. They hid behind the reasonable-sounding talking point that there is no evidence of expanding patient access through right to try. Yet the very reason why right to try doesn't expand patient access is precisely because companies don't want to take the risk of pissing off their bureaucratic regulator. In sum, even though the American people went through the proper democratic process to pass right to try legislation, it's wholly futile. Why? Because the FDA's managerial class just doesn't like it. Congress passes laws, but it can't prevent administrative agencies from exercising soft power. When the FDA blows its dog whistle, the pharmaceutical industry listens very carefully. This is the fourth branch of government in action. It's the real deep state, not a conspiratorial kind, but a much more mundane version. They teach us in high school that there are three branches of government: legislative, executive, and judicial. That's certainly what the Constitution says. Yet in real life, the fourth branch of government, the administrative state, is often more powerful than any of the other three. This alphabet soup of government agencies, SEC, FAA, FTC, HHS, FCC, and so on, runs the day-to-day affairs of the federal government, staffed by civil servants largely insulated from political accountability. The reality is that most career staffers at the FDA genuinely care about protecting public health, just as most career staffers at the CIA genuinely care about protecting national security. That noble motivation guides their day-to-day actions, occasionally combined with a hunger for relevance and power. They usually make sound scientific judgments. Even when these staffers are wrong, they often have good reasons for wanting things to be done in a certain way. But my chief complaint isn't that these technocrats are making the wrong judgments. It's that they use their technocratic authority to subvert the will of the American people. Right or wrong on the merits, that is an insult to democracy. In 2016, political scientist Michael Lind observed that the greatest threat to Western democracy is its gradual decay under well-educated, well-mannered, and well-funded elites. According to Lind, modern American government implicitly transfers political power from national legislatures to executive agencies, transnational bureaucracies, and treaty organizations. Congress's toothless right to try law is emblematic of the problem that Lind described. But my focus goes beyond government. Today, there's a deep corporation problem in the private sector as well. The perpetrators are the hired C-suite managers at large companies. Just like government bureaucrats, these executives often implicitly frustrate the will of a corporation's shareholders. Their main goal is to aggregate power for themselves in the name of serving their companies and society. Similar to the three branches of government, there are three legs to the stool of any company: founders, investors, and employees. Founders start companies, investors fund companies, and employees work for companies. It's supposed to be simple. But as in government, especially at America's largest corporations, there's now an invisible fourth leg to the stool: the managerial class. The folks who sit in glass-walled corner offices in Manhattan skyscrapers or communal beanbags in Silicon Valley and use the company piggy bank to travel to Davos each January. They're high-paid bureaucrats charged with balancing the interests of founders, investors, and employees. These managers often make handsome salaries, but they own much less of the company than founders and investors do. In general, they're not billionaires, and they're not playing the capitalist game just for money. They're playing for power. Academics like Michael Jensen and Eugene Fama have commented at length about the incentive misalignments between hired corporate managers and their shareholders. They wrote a famous paper in 1998 entitled Separation of Ownership and Control, which made the basic observation that managers own very little of firms, yet wield day-to-day control of them. And that in turn creates so-called agency costs, an economic term referring to the value an entity loses when it outsources some of its decision-making to an entity with different interests. But misalignments arising from differential ownership are only part of the story. In the real world, there's an even bigger issue. Shareholders of public companies are generally anonymous, while CEOs and other corporate managers are personally well-known. Unlike shareholders, managers have a personal reputation to maintain. Unlike a shareholder, a corporate manager's main asset isn't wealth. It's social stature. That's their ticket to wielding power, to getting hired to run another company in the future, to gaining a membership at a prestigious golf club, to getting appointed to a cushy job as an ambassador. According to academics like Jensen and Fama, the role of a corporation's board is to oversee CEOs and other managers to protect shareholders from their actions. Problem solved? Not quite. In the real world, most board members are themselves hired hands. In other words, themselves members of the managerial class. These independent directors are well compensated for their services, often six-figure or even seven-figure sums for attending one half-day board meeting per quarter. There's a reason they call it sitting on a board. In practice, this class of independent directors is now populated by people who professionally serve in that capacity, some of whom become lifers in that role. Some are ex-politicians. Some are ex-CEOs and ex-CFOs. Others are retired partners of large law firms or accounting firms. Regardless of their backgrounds, these repeat players in the game know where their bread is buttered. In practice, they aren't selected by public shareholders. Most often, they're selected by CEOs themselves. Every time I've personally been asked to join the board of a public company, it's almost always the CEO of that company who invites me to do it. To date, I've always declined. Personally, I find the idea of serving as another CEO's pawn about as appealing as a sharp poke in the eye. So in sum, independent directors get paid a lot of money to provide oversight of CEOs at public companies. Yet those CEOs are effectively the main ones who select and influence the people who will oversee them. Sounds like a racket? Welcome to the world of the managerial class. The consequences aren't just bad for corporate shareholders. They're bad for America. Michael Lind correctly observed that the most important managers are private and public bureaucrats who run large national and global corporations and exercise disproportionate influence in politics and society. Political theorist James Burnham first wrote about this phenomenon in his 1941 bestseller, The Managerial Revolution. In 1946, George Orwell summarized Burnham's theory well. Capitalism is disappearing, but socialism is not replacing it. What is now arising is a new kind of planned, centralized society, which will be neither capitalist nor, in any accepted sense of the word, democratic. The rulers of this new society will be business executives, technicians, bureaucrats, and soldiers, lumped together by Burnham under the name of managers. These people will eliminate the old capitalist class, crush the working class, and so organize society that all power and economic privilege remain in their own hands. One of the main motivations of hired CEOs is to maintain their personal reputation in order to open future doors for themselves. But that goes beyond future job opportunities or country club memberships. If it were just that, corporate shareholders might be the victims, but no one else. As Lind argues, the public, private, and nonprofit sectors in the modern West no longer have clear lines separating them. Rather, they are all populated by a common stock. Diplomats become investment bankers. Investment bankers become ambassadors. Generals sit on corporate boards. Corporate executives sit on nonprofit boards. That enables what Lind calls managerial dominance reinforced by lateral mobility at the top levels of society. That managerial dominance subverts the will of the American people. It renders our actual democracy impotent. Together, these bureaucrats crush the will of the shareholders they're supposed to represent, substituting democratic judgments with their own judgments, which are, of course, informed by their interest in preserving their own personal interests and reputations. In adopting the multi-stakeholder model, the corporate managerial class has pulled off the perfect con. CEOs can do whatever they want, as long as they say they have everyone's best interests in mind. Wokenomics is a powerful weapon for CEOs, which they can readily deploy as a smokescreen to distract from greed, fraud, and malfeasance. It provides the perfect alibi. Accountability to everyone is accountability to no one at all. No man can serve two masters. Corporate executives know that better than anyone. They claim to serve both shareholders and stakeholders, but as you'll see, when they have to pick one master to serve, they serve themselves. Consider the case of Volkswagen. Its managerial class claimed to serve everyone. Its CEO trumpeted that under his leadership, the company had become a good steward of the environment, a good servant to its customers, and a good investment for its shareholders. But that was all lip service. In the end, Volkswagen's executives really only helped themselves. Volkswagen appeared to have achieved its well-publicized goal of becoming the world's leading automaker in early 2015. Global sales figures showed it beating Toyota for first place. Volkswagen had been working toward this goal for a decade, with a particular focus on achieving massive sales growth in the U.S., the world's largest car market. Volkswagen had previously been a small player in the U.S. It changed that with a prominent clean diesel marketing campaign, positioning its cars as environmentally friendly alternatives to hybrids like the Toyota Prius. The PR campaign paid off. In September 2015, the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, the DJSI, named Volkswagen the most sustainable automobile company in the world. It had earned a near-perfect score, with full marks for codes of conduct, compliance, and anti-corruption, as well as innovation management and climate change strategy. Volkswagen chairman and CEO Martin Winterkorn had spearheaded Volkswagen's transformation from a middling automaker to the world's largest in just a few years at the helm. By 2014, Winterkorn had successfully steered Volkswagen to the top with his climate-conscious strategy. In an annual letter to shareholders, he said, "The automotive industry is currently experiencing fundamental change. Look no further than the increasingly stringent CO2 legislation or the rapid digitization of vehicles, plants, and showrooms. This costs us a great deal of energy and money too, but at Volkswagen, we do not see this transition as a threat, but rather as a tremendous opportunity, one that we must and will take advantage of." Winterkorn and Volkswagen did indeed take advantage of a tremendous opportunity. A week after their self-congratulatory press release, the U.S. EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, issued a formal notice of violation to the German automaker, alleging that Volkswagen had installed software, or defeat devices, in its cars to circumvent EPA emission standards. EPA had discovered that nearly 500,000 Volkswagen diesel cars on American roads were emitting up to 40 times more toxic fumes than permitted by the Clean Air Act. EPA would later uncover that up to 590,000 cars were implicated. 2 days later, Volkswagen leadership publicly admitted to cheating on emissions tests and revealed the defeat devices were installed in 11 million cars around the world. The defeat devices allowed the cars to detect when they were being driven under test conditions and to change performance and anti-pollution controls to appear more environmentally compliant. Under normal circumstances requiring greater performance, the cars would go back to guzzling gas. The negative news sent Volkswagen's stock price tumbling 50% from its all-time high. It was quietly cut from the DJSI. Volkswagen initially accused a group of rogue engineers of perpetuating the fraud. But over time, it became clear that it was using them as scapegoats to shield top executives. In a July 2015 executive team meeting, Winterkorn was allegedly alerted to EPA and California Air Resources Board, or CARB, refusals to permit the sale of Volkswagen model year 2016 diesel cars due to an emissions test anomaly. Winterkorn was reportedly very engaged in the technical aspects of the cheating. He directed underlings to seek an informal meeting with a senior-level CARB official, according to a sentencing memo in a U.S. criminal case against Volkswagen engineers. An FBI affidavit said that, rather than advocate for disclosure of the defeat device to U.S. regulators, executive management authorized its continued concealment. On orders from above, Volkswagen engineers lied to CARB officials. They eventually confessed, which triggered the EPA notice. Winterkorn ultimately took responsibility for overseeing the scandal and resigned shortly after Volkswagen's admission. But he denied any early knowledge of the defeat devices. Volkswagen itself was hit with fines from U.S. and German authorities. And in September 2020, 5 years after Volkswagen's cheating admission, Winterkorn was ordered to face trial in Germany on charges of fraud. This followed an April 2019 indictment of Winterkorn and other Volkswagen senior executives. A German district court said in a statement that there was a substantial probability of conviction based on the evidence provided in the indictment. Here's the key takeaway from the Volkswagen affair. Critics of Volkswagen often cite it as a paradigmatic example of the evils of shareholder capitalism. They say that if Volkswagen hadn't been so focused on short-term profits, it wouldn't have cheated. But this crude conclusion belies a more subtle point. The scandal only happened in the first place because Volkswagen gained market clout by advertising its supposedly clean diesel cars. Being the environmentalist golden boy was what made Volkswagen so successful selling snake oil for a decade. If only what happened at Volkswagen had been an isolated incident. Unfortunately, it's just one example in a long and ongoing history of executive wrongdoing in the name of stakeholders. There's Wirecard, a German ESG darling, that used its sterling reputation to cover up the fact that it committed massive fraud by generating $1.9 billion in fake transactions. There's Nikola, a supposed Tesla rival whose executive chairman Trevor Milton promised to save the planet with its hydrogen-powered vehicles, only to quickly unravel as he was, in a matter of days, accused of fraud and sexual abuse and investigated by the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's WeWork, a trendy, socially conscious VC-backed hero that imploded under the weight of CEO Adam Neumann's voluminous self-dealing. The list goes on. I could write an entire chronicle on each of these nefarious episodes, but that's not the point of this book. Just for fun, though, let's go through one more example. This time, I'll take you behind the curtain to show how pharmaceutical companies use stakeholder capitalism as a smokescreen to continue doing business as usual. In September 2015, Hillary Clinton famously tweeted, "Price gouging like this in the specialty drug market is outrageous. Tomorrow, I'll lay out a plan to take it on." In response to a New York Times article detailing Martin Shkreli's exorbitant price increase of Daraprim by over 5,000%. Clinton was the Democratic presidential frontrunner, so her comments sent biotech markets into a tailspin. Clinton's concerns were echoed by then-Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. The writing was on the wall for pharma companies. Drug pricing would be a policy focus of any new administration, and the industry was losing in the court of public opinion. So what did it do in response? In 2016, the pharma industry created an unofficial social contract to limit drug price increases to 10% per year. Allergan CEO Brent Saunders kicked it off by pledging to increase prices at most once per year and to do it by single digits. Other companies quickly fell in line. This created a new norm of all companies raising their prices by, of course, about 9.9%. A price increase of 10% per year, compounding each year, adds up quickly, but slowly enough to escape the public's notice. The pharma industry's insight was that it could continue to raise prices, but that it needed to do so in stages, rather than all at once. Then the companies could condition the public to accept price increases as normal, while also making themselves seem socially responsible by only raising them 10%. If government regulators stepped in, drug prices would be restricted far more. As one article put it, "As rising drug prices continue to be a major cause for discord in the U.S., the self-regulation of price hikes could help the industry avoid regulatory reform." With rising drug prices more constrained in 2017 and 2018, the pharma industry may be on its way to dodging federal regulation. Stakeholder capitalism has created a world in which ordinary people not only expect, but also assume, companies pursue not just their own interests, but societal interests too. Yet when we make that assumption, we as consumers are less likely to question those companies' business decisions. Customer cynicism is a powerful force in the market too, one that any well-functioning market depends on, but also one that gets blunted by corporate stakeholderism. Pharma companies know this. That's exactly what they have in mind when they make hollow declarations to help stave off climate change or make public commitments to cap the magnitude of annual price increases that they take. By acting like the good guys, as Wokenomics demands they do, pharma companies are actually able to get away with behavior that leaves society worse off in the end. It's no accident that Allergan, the very company that kicked off the societal pledge to cap its annual price increases, was also the company that just a couple of years later tried to skirt the U.S. patent regime by making a legally dubious deal with a Native American tribe as a gambit to enjoy prolonged immunity from generic competition. Allergan had sold the rights to a best-selling eye drug to the St. Regis Mohawk tribe, who were then going to claim sovereign immunity to dismiss a challenge to the patent from generic pharmaceutical manufacturers, a standard step in the process of how generic drugs reach the market when branded pharmaceutical patents expire. The tribe was going to lease the patent back to Allergan and get $15 million in annual royalties, which in turn would have allowed Allergan to still book hundreds of millions of dollars in added profits per year. Hiding behind Native Americans was a daring legal move for the pharmaceutical giant, though the Supreme Court spoiled the fun by forbidding it. So even as Allergan was paying lip service to stakeholders by proposing some grand bargain limiting price hikes, it was brazenly bypassing the regular old deal between society and drug developers. The standard deal is that patents allow you to charge higher prices for a time to reward the resources the company spent on research and development. And in return, once the patent expires, society gets to make cheap generics and reap the benefits of the drug in perpetuity. As Allergan was pledging to limit price increases for the sake of stakeholders, it was trying to use the Mohawk's sovereign immunity as a legal shield to allow it to keep its patent and charge monopoly prices forever to those same stakeholders. It was hypocrisy of the highest degree. Allergan wanted to raise those prices 10% per year forever instead of letting the party end someday. I believe that America is better off if we simply accept the system that we have for fostering pharmaceutical innovation. Sure, it needs some technical tweaks here and there, but broadly speaking, the system works for delivering life-saving cures to people who need them. We should recognize that this means pharma companies will act in their self-interest by charging relatively high prices for their drugs while patent-protected, but make them available dirt cheap thereafter. If that happens, then we're all better off in the end. But when we demand that those same companies behave as societal benefactors by charging lower prices, even while their drugs are on patent, then those same companies simply use that do-good smokescreen as a weapon to evade the market mechanisms we already have in place to check pharmaceutical prices. Capitalism tends to work well when everyone knows what to expect. The less clear those expectations are, the better the system works for the managerial class, but worse for society at large. How do we end the tyranny of the corporate managerial class? Here's a thought. Limit the scope of the business judgment rule, or the BJR, as it's often called. In practice, most examples of stakeholder capitalism in the real world start with the CEO who decides to use the company's corporate platform to solve a social problem. This often results in the CEO making bad business decisions that have negative externalities for democracy. Yet they are aided by the BJR, a corporate privilege that is designed to protect CEOs and corporate directors from being sued for the bad business decisions that they make. There are good reasons for this legal doctrine, but today it applies far too broadly in a way that is toxic both for companies and for democracy. Here's how it works. The BJR protects directors and officers of a corporation in the event that they are sued for violating their duty of care to a company. According to this rule, a court will uphold the decisions of a director as long as they are made, 1, in good faith, 2, with care that a reasonably prudent person would use, and 3, with the reasonable belief that the director is acting in the best interests of the corporation. In practice, every corporate lawyer knows that the BJR means that an officer or director of a company is off the hook as a legal defendant in a case. The general logic for the BJR is obvious, that qualified people would never want to serve as directors and officers if they risked being sued every time they made a business decision that looked bad in retrospect. It's supposed to apply to business decisions, not social decisions. In practice, the only way for a plaintiff to pierce the BJR is this. If the plaintiff can prove that the director had a conflict of interest when making a decision, then the BJR doesn't apply. Today, we define conflicts of interest exclusively in financial terms. For example, if you serve on the board of a company, but that company is also a major customer of another company that you own, then that's a conflict of interest that disqualifies you from benefiting from the BJR. It makes sense that we shouldn't just take your business judgment at face value in that case. But suppose you're a progressive ex-politician, one who might want to get appointed as Secretary of Health and Human Services at some point during Biden's tenure as president, and you're on the board of a pharmaceutical company. I happen to know a few people who probably fit that description. Now suppose it comes to a decision on how you're supposed to price a drug. You obviously have a conflict of interest, even though it's not a strictly financial conflict of interest. Therein lies the rub. In real life, not all conflicts of interest are financial. They show up in many forms and flavors. Not all human motivations are financial. In fact, most aren't. That's what allows woke corporatism, the flavor of woke capitalism that's driven by hired CEOs and board members rather than the shareholders themselves, to thrive. A critical feature that distinguishes executives and independent directors, members of the managerial class, from shareholders is that the former have a reputation to maintain, while the latter do not. This is itself a conflict of interest, even though it's not one that the law recognizes today. To be clear, I'm not arguing that CEOs or directors should be legally prohibited from using corporate resources to support their own pet social causes. Sweeping government prohibitions, designed to solve a narrow set of cases, usually do more harm than good. Rather, my proposed solution is much more modest. I'm just saying CEOs and directors shouldn't be protected by the BJR if a shareholder sues them for doing so. Why? Because using the corporate dime needed to fund your favorite social cause is no less a conflict of interest than a classical financial conflict of interest. The BJR was never intended to protect executives from liability for corporate actions that weren't motivated by maximizing profits for shareholders in the first place. Legal scholars almost universally agree that the only reason for the BJR is that executives and directors are supposed to be the stewards for protecting shareholder value. That's why it's called the business judgment rule, not the social judgment rule. The BJR makes little sense if it protects executives who act on their own whims and interests instead of maximizing shareholder value. The very risk of bearing personal liability for a new class of conflicts of interest that didn't previously exist would have the effect of changing corporate behavior, in my opinion, strictly for the better. Executives will at least think twice about the shareholder-centric justification before writing a check to BLM or exhorting their customers to support Joe Biden or Donald Trump or whatever it is they feel an impulse to do from their seat of corporate power. The power of the managerial class is now spreading like a plague to other spheres of our society. It afflicts governments, nonprofits, universities, and even hospitals. It's a cultural cancer that threatens to erode American identity in each of these institutions from within. So far, I've discussed stakeholder capitalism, a game in which greedy executives play stakeholders and shareholders against each other to make sure that they're answerable to no one. That's my main focus in this book. But I would be remiss not to point out that stakeholder capitalism is only part of a broader phenomenon that I call stakeholderism, in which institutions beyond for-profit corporations invoke amorphous stakeholders to justify expanding their original missions to suit their managers' personal desires. This stakeholderism is perhaps nowhere more dangerous today than at universities, where the next generation of elites is being educated right now. The core mission of a university is supposed to be education, and universities' relevant stakeholders were originally supposed to be their students, the ones who were paying them to be educated. But as socially conscious managers have gradually taken over the universities, they've expanded their conception of stakeholders to include racial minorities, sexual minorities, future generations, the environment, and whatever other groups progressive activists say they should care about. So the students are still the stakeholders footing the bill, but their money is now paying to support nebulous, distant stakeholders, like future generations, whose will liberal administrators get to represent. A 2014 analysis found that from 1987 to 2012, the higher education sector added more than 500,000 administrators. Their numbers have doubled relative to academic faculty, and the cloud of these administrators has also grown alongside their numbers. As Philip Hamburger of Columbia Law School has argued, the balance of power at universities has increasingly shifted toward administrators who increasingly control academic policy. In his book, Restoring the Promise, Higher Education in America, economist Richard Vedder calculates that if the ratio of campus bureaucrats to faculty had held steady since 1976, there would be 537,317 fewer administrators, saving universities $30.5 billion per year and allowing student tuition to decrease by 20%. It's no wonder college costs so much these days. Today, university administrators are generally monolithic in their political perspectives, choking the free exchange of diverse ideas at universities. Samuel Abrams, visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, found that liberal staff members outnumber their conservative counterparts by an astonishing ratio of 12 to 1. Yet ironically, the fastest growth in recent years has been in the area of diversity administrators. Mark Perry, an economics professor at the University of Michigan Flint, recently calculated that his university has nearly 100 diversity administrators, with a total cost of approximately $14 million per year, or $300 per enrolled student. Just as in corporations, the goals of these university administrators are misaligned with the goals of the principals, in this case, the university itself. The diversity administrator has a vested interest in perpetually preserving the perception of a diversity problem, or else their own job becomes superfluous. Remember, Michael Lind framed the rise of the managerial class as part of a battle between elites and ordinary people, one the elites were winning. There's some truth to that account, but it's too low resolution. Not all elites are the same. Both professors and university administrators are elites, but their contributions, roles, and essential character are completely different from one another. Professors come up with new, wild, often controversial ideas. University administrators? Well, administer things. In my view, zany professors are more likely to help the university realize its own essential purpose than any administrator. The same goes for companies. Founders, investors, and hired C-suite managers are all elites in the grand scheme of things. But that entirely misses an important power struggle within the corporation itself, between the founder shareholder class and the managerial class. To me, America is about empowering true innovators like founders, true risk takers like investors, true thinkers like professors, and true elected leaders over the bureaucratic intermediaries who are hired to manage them all. So the real problem with the rise of the managerial class isn't simply that the elites are winning and ordinary people are losing. It's that the essential purpose of an institution, be it a company or a university, is less likely to be realized when it's led by a manager than when it's led by someone who embodies the essence of what that institution does. That's where my view departs from Lynn's. We both agree that the rise of the managerial class is a fundamental problem for America, but Lynn views it as a battle between elites and ordinary people. By contrast, I view it as a battle between hired hands and those who embody the essence of an institution, like professors at universities, doctors at hospitals, or founders and shareholders at companies. When viewed through my lens rather than Lynn's, the relevance of all of this to stakeholderism becomes clear. Stakeholderism is the philosophy that posits institutions should not only advance their essential purpose, but also advance societal goals that go beyond the institution's essential purpose. On its face, that philosophy sounds benign enough. Sure, you could argue that a university is worse at educating students if its administration is also focused on, say, addressing climate change or fighting racism. But you could equally argue that engaging with those social questions makes the university better positioned to educate students on how to address important societal challenges. Reasonable minds can differ. But that's not really what stakeholderism is about. At its core, it's a tool that empowers the managerial class and allows them to escape accountability for their failures to properly advance the essential purpose of an institution. It's what gives university administrators, or charity administrators, or hospital administrators, or fancy New York City private school administrators greater power and insulation from the people they're supposed to be accountable to. And that's a critical part of the cultural cancer afflicting America today. Not just the government, but companies, universities, museums, philanthropies, and even religious institutions. If that's true for stakeholderism broadly, then it's most acute in the case of stakeholder capitalism. Here's why. The number one rule of the game for any CEO to consolidate power is this: the more people you're accountable to, the more powerful you become. In my industry, that's why nearly every hired CEO wants to take their company public if given the choice. Why? As a private company, you're accountable to a small group of shareholders, often venture capitalists and private equity firms, who are looking over your shoulder at every step of the way. But as a public company, you get to be accountable to thousands of shareholders, most of whom you'll never meet, and most of whom will never meet each other. That means even if one shareholder isn't happy with what you do, you can always claim that another one was. That's nearly impossible to do at a closely held private company. If it's true that CEOs become less accountable by becoming accountable to more people, then stakeholder capitalism empowers the corporate managerial class to consummate their coup. By becoming accountable to literally everyone, they become accountable to no one. That's the heart of the problem of stakeholder capitalism. It's not about serving stakeholders rather than shareholders. It's about serving the managerial class itself. With the rise of the managerial class, America is becoming less and less like itself and more like a bastardized version of the European model of social progress, where elite executives work hand in hand with government to do what they think is best for society. Maybe this works for Europe. I'd say that America's history of innovation shows that our corporate focus on shareholder value works better, though that's an argument to be had elsewhere. My point is different. If America claims to be America, but quietly yet gradually moves toward the European model through the back door, we'll just become a worse version of Europe and a worse version of ourselves. We could become a worse version of Japan, too. I've done a lot of business there, and I was surprised to find that in Japan, it often doesn't matter what the CEO of a company says. The managers at that company will, in many cases, do what they want because people can't be fired. They don't work for the CEO if the CEO can't actually fire them. Maybe that model works well for Japan. But our social culture is different, so our corporate culture must be as well. These observations are based on confidential conversations with executives, consultants, and investment bankers in Japan, and are nonspecific to the pharma industry. The main issue with the rise of the managerial class in the U.S. is this. American employees harbor a self-interested greed that Japanese employees often do not. That self-interest is a fuel for good if channeled through a system like ours that was built on that premise, but wouldn't work as well in the Japanese or European system. America's competitive advantage rests in harnessing our self-interested impulses toward building something greater than ourselves. But if we try to pretend that we're Japan, where ordinary people behave according to duty rather than self-interest, then when our people don't actually behave that way, the new American model will be worse than either the classical capitalist model, the European model, or the Japanese model, and will be a broken version of all of them. America's identity was always about the power of the people overcoming the managerial class, in our democracy and also culturally in our universities, companies, and government. The rise of the managerial class is a disease afflicting the soul of our most important institutions. History teaches that what begins as an accountability crisis for individual companies, if left unchecked, becomes a crisis for the system as a whole. Chapter 5, The ESG Bubble. Earlier this year, I got a call from the House Financial Services Committee to testify as an expert about a seemingly abstruse issue. New SEC rules that would require U.S. public companies to regularly disclose so-called ESG factors. Congress was weighing new laws to require companies to disclose not only their financial metrics in their quarterly and annual reports, but also environmental, social, and governance factors as well, things like racial and gender diversity in the workforce, climate change impact, and so on. As I listened to the Democratic congressmen and their witnesses lay out the case for these new SEC rules, I had a flashback to my own experience watching the 2008 financial crisis. In fact, my own induction into the business world began with the 2008 financial crisis. No doubt that shaped my own cynicism of Wall Street from early on. In 2007, I joined a firm called QVT Financial right after I had graduated from Harvard. I was a young analyst on a biotech team that represented, at least at the time, a tiny portion of the sprawling hedge fund. The people who ran the firm were physics majors from places like Harvard and Caltech, who discovered that they could make more money trading complex securities than working in a lab. The firm's culture was distinct from its peers. It lacked the artifice of Goldman Sachs and the frivolity of Amaranth. Its leaders were among the smartest people I'd ever meet. They were obsessed with figuring out the truth and making contrarian bets, not just about stocks, but about people too. If I'd been judged simply on my math skills, I doubt I'd ever have made it through the interview process. I owe a lot of my success to their willingness to take an early bet on me. Dan Gold, the founder and CEO of QVT, sat at the center of the trading floor, flanked by multiple computer monitors and telephones. He was the fixed point around which the rest of the firm turned. The most important people sat closest to Dan, and the guy who sat to his right was Arthur Chu. In the same year that I joined QVT, Arthur and his team figured out something that very few people in the financial world recognized. There was a bubble in mortgage-backed securities in the United States. He and Dan made a series of complex bets that their prices would fall, and they were right, making QVT one of the most profitable hedge funds in the world in 2007, and earning it a mention in Michael Lewis's bestseller, The Big Short, despite Dan's request that Lewis not mention the company in the book. The standard explanation for the subprime mortgage bubble was that predatory lenders were greedy sharks who took advantage of the opportunity to make home loans to individual borrowers who weren't very creditworthy. That's why they were called subprime mortgages. Prime mortgages were home loans made to people with reasonable creditworthiness. Subprime referred to everything else. Wall Street banks bundled up these different mortgages to reduce risk and then sold them to speculative investors. That bundle is what we call mortgage-backed securities. But the unsatisfying thing about blaming greed for the 2008 financial crisis is that it fails to account for the fact that the greediest and smartest thing that someone could have done in 2005 and 2006 was to bet against those mortgages. In retrospect, it should have been obvious that many of these subprime borrowers would default on their home loans, and that's exactly what happened. If Wall Street bankers were so greedy, then why did so many of them fail to capitalize on the opportunity? The true culprit was upstream of that greed. Starting in the 1990s, the U.S. government embarked on an ambitious policy to drive home ownership. The idea of owning a home was seen as the pinnacle of the American dream. So the government decided to make that dream come true by creating special categories of loans to spur more home ownership, including among people whose incomes didn't support the value of the homes they went on to buy. That's where government swamp creatures like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came from. Though they were technically created during the Great Depression, they took on a role of renewed importance under President Clinton. The real question isn't why predatory lenders in the early 2000s lent money to a bunch of borrowers who had poor credit scores. It's why bad predatory lenders had all that money to give out in the first place. Answer: bad government policy. That ought to be one of our key lessons from the 2008 financial crisis. Socially driven economic policy risks creating asset bubbles. And when those bubbles burst, they end up hurting the very causes and people the original policy was intended to help. That's exactly what happened when the mortgage bubble burst in 2007, especially when that subsequently led to the failure of large financial institutions in 2008. If you want to learn more about that whole phenomenon, read The Big Short, which provides a full account of the subprime mortgage bubble and the people who made money by boldly betting against it. In reality, the factors behind the 2008 financial crisis were multiple and complex. I can't sum it up succinctly here, and my reason for bringing it up isn't to offer a history lesson. Rather, it's a warning. It's exactly what I saw on display during the congressional hearing where I testified earlier this year. President Biden and his comrades in Congress were trying to tilt the scales of how today's investors allocate capital to promote a social agenda. Except this time, it was to foster racial diversity and climate justice rather than home ownership. It's distorting how investors allocate capital. And just like last time, I don't think it will end well. For the purposes of argument, assume that when I refer to ESG investing, I'm referring to the now widespread practice of large investment funds who raise capital under the banner of investing in ESG-friendly companies and who then go on to invest in companies that successfully convince them that they are indeed ESG-friendly companies. Let's start with first principles. In theory, if the market works according to its normal rules, these ESG investors ought to accept a systematically lower rate of return as part of the bargain for investing in companies that adhere to their principles. Accepting lower returns from ESG investing isn't just an unfortunate consequence of trying to do social good. To the contrary, it's precisely what you'd predict would happen if you traded off traditional investment factors for social ones. In fact, if you're an authentic, ESG-oriented investor who cares about environmental and social goals, this is a desirable outcome. In fact, the only way you can effect changes that you want to see. In demonstrating why, I'm going to borrow heavily from an argument made by Cliff Asness, founder of AQR Capital Management. AQR stands for Applied Quantitative Research, a successful global investment manager with around $150 billion in assets under management. Notably, AQR offers multiple ESG investment products. But the difference between AQR and other ESG investors is that AQR doesn't try to lure its clients with the false promise that applying virtue to investing will somehow make them more money. Let's start with the common ESG investing practice of avoiding so-called sin stocks. Sin stocks include companies with businesses in industries that are considered unethical, immoral, or unsavory. Historically, sin stocks included businesses in the alcohol, gambling, tobacco, and weapons sectors. Asness explains that investors who practice negative screening